everything is there. There's no meaning to unlimited without limited.
Sure.
It's just a logical way of explaining that.
Yeah, because you know, I was always quite puzzled as to why all this that was very Indian, you know, labor as far as the names and the culture, you know. And I asked them about it. They said, "Oh, I said, why was it India where all this stuff happened? Why not Norway or something, you know?"
New Zealand.
Well.
You become a pure lover of Krishna and make it happen in New Zealand. Sean! Here's our friend Paul. Page 1. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Lalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yatapara Kamalam Shri Garun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakham Vitangsa Hey Krishna Karana Sindhu Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sutta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpataruvyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Pajitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasari Go Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Welcome everyone to Friday's Gita seminar. As you can see on the board, tonight we'll be going over these two topics. First one, equality on the material plane is impossible. You may know that sociologists and historians of the 20th century agree that probably the most overriding characteristic of the 20th century is the universal quest for egalitarianism. Equality. Equality in terms of gender, equality in terms of race or ethnic groups, or whether it's manifesting in political rights or employment rights, or how one group is referred to by others. Egalitarianism, like never before, has sprouted in this century as the predominant characteristic. Now, equality on the material plane. In other words, equality from the material point of view. Is it really possible, or are we just chasing a pipe dream? Any thoughts on that before we turn to our section of Bhagavad Gita? C. see how this point is dealt with. Any comments on equality, egalitarianism?
It's very complex, I think.
You speak
on it. You can talk about equal rights, you know, but actual equality, you'd have to. It's different for whatever you're talking about, in a way. Like there are rights which can be equal, but for instance, you can't say that say men and women will be equal in all things because you know of the obvious differences. So physically, you can say men and women won't be equal, but they may have equal rights. So I think it just gets quite complex depending on what you're talking about, really. But you'll probably have another slant altogether, I'm sure.
I'm quiet. I'm just, you know. Everyone's just presenting their insights. Anyone else? Sir Ron?
Mark, can you have a little more air? Sitting on that. Equality in the material plane, is that what you're saying? Or that what the subject is?
Yes.
If you open that one, it'll get noisy. That phone that gets noisy. Those other two should do it.
Well, I feel, I don't think there can be equality on the material plane. Because the material plane is an external condition. The external condition is, if you view it from an individual person, it's different. Individual person. So it's out there. It's totally different for everybody. So equality for me would not be possible with anything external.
Because of the, you're saying that equality is impossible for anything external because of the very nature of externality, is that what you're saying? I think you're saying something else. I'm just clarifying.
I think I'm saying that individually, materialism is an external thing. Whether we like it or not, it's an external thing. It is external. And individually, looking at it from an individual, from my point of view, I would look at something externally totally different from anyone else. So consequently, if you look at it on an external thing with view to looking from, with the view of two people, they can look at one thing is totally different than somebody else. So equality can never exist.
Oh. Well, I'm not supposed to be commenting at this point, but I would become intrigued by what is internal in reference to what is external. If I was meant to be a first-class materialist, I'd say, Ron, I think you're not understanding it. It's all external. It's all that there is. In fact, we don't want to get into any vitalistic discussions about the ghost in the machine. It's just all matter.
I think I'm getting sort of at my depth, sort of discussing it in those terms, because the restriction I find is equality and materialism. You used another word. When you're discussing on those two terms, I find my mind will clag up.
Right. It's all matter going through processes. But I think I would suggest we bear that in mind, though. What each individual is looking at externals differently. So we have to actually find out then what is the internal that's looking at the external. That's what I was trying to get at.
You were asking me a question. I was just answering your question. I wouldn't tell you how to solve the question.
Okay, Ron, you're in good form tonight.
Obviously, it's happening right now.
Any others on equality on the material plane? Paul, anything?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. Equal in what way? I don't think that as the body we can be equal. I think there's so many different situations around. Some people are disadvantaged, some people have lots of money, got lots of wealth or whatever. so, well, externally, from an outward point of view, so they're not equal. They're not equal on the material plane. You can't be equal on the material plane. Yeah, all that's hard.
Well, I just have some words on the board there. It says equality on the material planes. I'm not saying we yet what, you know.
Well, if you're talking about how much wealth is spread around, or not wealth, but material gain, you know, or position in society. Yeah. Well, things are related to equality.
I mean, equality of what, anyway? You know.
We're just letting things percolate for now.
Would you like to? Joan, right?
Yes,
okay.
Well, I think we're not born equal anyway. Some people strive to become superior on a material plane, then find that they don't want it anyway. So, no, I don't think we're equal. And I would be inclined to agree that all of us are. But it's even
sounds like another vitalist, one who believes in the ghost and the machine, thinking there's something internal to the body and mind. All right. So I see we have a really. Anyone else, Joanna? Really, I mean, I think there's a lot of people in Auckland who would become very indignant about this, these comments here, because so many people take this point very seriously. How dare you say it's not possible? But of course, some or other, you all are looking at issues very clearly. And of course, if we turn to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, text 18, you'll find that very point is addressed, as everyone is hinting at. On a material plane, equality is impossible because bodies are inherently dissimilar. Now, but you should also realize that not everybody sees things as clearly as you do. Many people are adamant about trying to arrange things so that every body is considered equal. In other words, my body can do whatever yours can. And if it can't, it means because, well, I just have to learn, I have to be trained more, or I have to do this or that, and I can do whatever you can. Illogical as it may seem to you all, a lot of people think that way. Of course, there's the issue of equality before the law. That's one thing. But you'd be surprised. So many people feel that equality means that each particular material body is as capable and competent in whatever aspect as another body. Now, when you think about it, it's ridiculous, but people are thinking that way. So let's look at what Krishna says in text 18 on page 293. Vijaya vinaya sampanye brahmane gavihastini shuni chaiva svapake cha pandita samadarshana. Paul, would you like to read the translation?
The humble sages, by virtue of true knowledge, see with equal vision a learned and gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a doggy cat.
So what are these different elements, first of all, that are cited in this example? The essential principle is the humble sages, because they have true knowledge, they see with equal vision. The Sanskrit is samadarshana. Sama means equal. Darshana, they see. Why do they see with equal vision? Not because of some kind of sentiment or theory or faddish philosophy, but because they actually are equipped with knowledge. Vidya. Real education. And real education, as we'll hear Krishna explain, has nothing to do with the external, as Ram was referring to. Or more particularly, the external is dealt with in real education, but it's put in its proper place. real education, vidya, the Sanskrit word, real education lets you know that the external exists, but it's insignificant, and the internal exists, and it's very important. And furthermore, that both the external and the internal emanate from the same source. These days you'll find a lot of people talking about the external and the internal. I've got to do some inner work. I've got to get my internal self together. But we should take things a step further and try to find out what is the source of the external and the source of the internal. And what is the relationship between the external and the internal? And why is there an external and an internal? That's real vidya, real education. Otherwise, you can start banding around a lot of loose concepts, you know. Just like the word spiritual has become very loose thing these days. I remember, for example, some years ago, in the city of Detroit, their professional ice hockey team was in the top of the league, and their professional basketball team was in the top of the league. So the news, one of the athletes was telling the newspaper reporters, there's really a kind of spiritual feeling in the city as of late because both teams are at the top of their league. And, you know, it was said like that, but no one objected. It was considered a, kind of a spiritual feeling because both our sports teams are doing so well. Kind of a spiritual feeling in the city. It was, you know, whereas 10 years ago, I don't think you would have found that kind of a thing in the newspapers. Now, anything that's kind of, I don't know, whatever you can see of as feeling good, it's spiritual.
I think that's a lot of it's deemed with energy as well. It's like the Warriors match, the Open Warriors match, the generation of energy in the atmosphere, that everybody was hyped, and there was a definite change in frequency, there was a lift. And I think spirituality is often mixed up with a change in energy.
I see.
That's my feeling.
Oh, yes. You remind me of our Kuka Falls example, which I may talk about later. When I was down at Lake Taupo a couple weeks ago, I was meditating on the Kuka Falls and going with the flow. So, we may speak about that later. So, real vidya, real knowledge, will teach you what is the external energy, you mentioned energy. What is the internal energy? What is the source of both energies? And the relationship between the source and the different energies. Otherwise, we just kind of say these terms very loosely and not take them to their conclusion. We kind of end up in perhaps airy-fairy-sville. So Bhagavad Gita, of course, as you know, there's nothing airy-fairy about Bhagavad Gita. It's very definitive. But sometimes here at the loft, we find out that people don't like definitiveness anymore. It's the out thing. And the more vague things are, the more airy, then the more spiritual it is. So as soon as anything is presented in a definitive way, and Bhagavad Gita is definitely the quintessence of being definitive, as soon as something is presented in a definitive way, then, oh, this must be sectarian, or, oh, this must be dogma, the dirty D word, dogma. But if it's loose and vague, oh, that's spiritual. So these are some of the little problems we run into on other nights, particularly Tuesday.
Celestine night.
You been on Tuesday?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
I've heard about it, though.
Okay, now Ron is pushing on to, once we've isolated the general principle. Humble sages, by virtue of true knowledge, see with equal vision. Now, these things that are given are examples of the equal vision. It's not that equal vision is restricted to just seeing these categories. These are just examples. And learned and gentle Brahmana. Brahmana, in Vedic culture, is a spiritual intellectual, one who has dedicated his life to studying spiritual science. practicing it. Spiritual teacher. Priestly class, you might say. A cow, everyone knows a cow is an elephant, everyone knows what that is, a dog, and a dog eater. From the Vedic cultural point of view, from the Vedic sociological point of view, the dog eater is, one who eats dogs has made himself to be very socially reprehensible. Because, first of all, from the Vedic sociological perspective, meat eating is very barbaric. And of the meat eaters, of those who eat meat, those who eat dogs, you notice even Westerners, they don't eat dogs. And you can go to Korea or other countries, they do. But so of those who eat flesh, the dog eaters are considered to be lowest on the pole from the Vedic sociological perspective. Because dog meat is considered to be particularly unclean and unfit for human consumption, even more so than other fleshes, which, of course, not considered so bizarre anymore because scientists and dietitians are pointing out that the human body has so much trouble digesting meat. So, therefore, these elements here are cited as examples of the Brahmins, of the humble sages' true knowledge and equal vision. How do you see a spiritual intellectual, a dog eater, and these animals, cow, elephant, and a dog, is the same? From the Vedic sociological perspective, it's not just these three animals, cow, elephant, and dog. The cow is considered to be especially valuable because the cow gives milk, not only to its young, but to human beings, too. Therefore, the cow is considered to be like a mother. And from the Vedic sociological perspective, the killing of the cow is actually equivalent to killing of one's mother. So, I think at this point, everyone's kind of grasped the dynamics of this text. Any questions on it?
When it says, see with equal vision, all these things, does that mean we've seen how apology on the material plane is impossible? Is this on a spiritual plane that we're talking about, that they're equal?
Okay, Paul. Please read the purport.
A Krishna conscious person does not make any distinction between species or castes. The Brahmana and the outcast may be different from the social point of view, or a dog, a cow, and an elephant may be different from the point of view of species. But these differences of body are meaningless from the viewpoint of a learned transcendentalist. This is due to their relationship to the Supreme. For the Supreme Lord, by his primary portion as Paramatma, is present in everyone's heart. Such an understanding of the Supreme is real knowledge. As far as the bodies are concerned, in different castes or different species of life, the Lord is equally kind to everyone because he treats every living being as a friend, yet maintains himself as Paramatma, regardless of the circumstances of the living entities. The Lord as Paramatma is present both in the outcast and in the Brahmana, although the body of the Brahmana and that of an outcast are not the same.
Yes, so here we have the point that the body will be there cannot be equality amongst bodies. Everyone here can see that quite clearly. That, for example, the male body cannot have a baby. The female body can have a baby. Even male bodies, which are supposed to be generally stronger than female bodies, they have varying degrees of strength. And body also includes the strength of the intelligence. And there are differing levels of intelligence. So, it's quite obvious that all bodies cannot be equal. But what is there that's equal? What is it that the real spiritual person is seeing that's the same? He's seeing that in everyone's core of existence, there is the super soul present, the complete whole appearing within the part. The Paramatma, this is Sanskrit, para means supreme, atma means self. Within the self, there is also the supreme self. In other words, the infinite is so extraordinarily unlimited and potent that the infinite can appear within the finite. that can't happen, then the infinite's limited. The finite is limited, but the infinite is not limited. Therefore, even within the finite, the infinite can appear, because the infinite has infinite possibilities. So, what the humble sage sees by virtue of true knowledge is the presence of the complete whole, Paramatma, Supersoul, in every creature's heart, whether human or animal. Although the bodies are unequal. In other words, in spite of material inequality, the Supersoul agrees to be present in each creature's heart. Regardless of the circumstances of that creature, whether it's a pig wallowing in the mud or a human being wallowing in the library.
But would the soul not be equal, the smaller individual soul, from individual to individual?
Yeah, please, you go on reading the purport. The Lord as
Paramatma is present both in the outcast and in the Brahmana, although the body of a Brahmana and that of an outcast are not the same. Bodies are material productions of different modes of material nature, but the soul and the supersoul within the body are of the same spiritual quality. The similarity in the quality of the soul and the supersoul, however, does not make them equal in quantity, for the individual soul is present only in that particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present in each and every body. Krishna conscious person has full knowledge of this, and therefore he is truly limited and has equal vision. The similar characteristics of the soul and supersoul are that they are both conscious, eternal, and blissful. But the difference is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body, whereas the supersoul is conscious of all bodies. The supersoul is present in all bodies without distinction.
Amongst the finite souls, there is equality. But between the finite soul and the infinite soul, there's only equality in quality, but not in quantity.
Mm-hmm. So there is some equality between
Individual
souls.
Yes.
Well, what about, I thought that some souls, you know, I thought there was just a whole range of different levels of evolution in the soul, you know, in terms of the karma.
But you see, let's go back to text 14 on page 288. This was last week.
Oh, yes. I wasn't here.
Yeah. But for you, we'll go back.
Okay.
Please read I'll read the Sanskrit. You can read the translation. Nakartritam nakamani lokasya shrijati prabhu nakarma palasam yogam sabhavas tu pravartate.
The embodied spirit, master of the city of his body, does not create activities, nor does he induce people to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature.
You can read the purport also if you like. Right.
The living entity, as will be explained in the 7th chapter, is one of the energies or natures of the Supreme Lord, but is distinct from matter, which is another nature, called inferior. Been in contact with material nature since time immemorial. The temporary body or material dwelling place which he obtains is the cause of varieties of activities and the resultant reactions. Living in such a conditional atmosphere, one suffers the results of the activities of the body by identifying himself in ignorance with the body. It is ignorance acquired from time immemorial that is the cause of bodily suffering and distress. As soon as the living entity becomes aloof from the activities of the body, he becomes free from the reactions as well.
Yes, so it's the temporary body or material dwelling place which he obtains is the cause of varieties of activities and the resultant reactions. In other words, as Ron was using Ron's vernacular, it's external. But of course, in order to use the word external, we must know what is internal.
Only the material situation that, that separates, you know, like spiritual advancement or whatever, then how come there are different levels of material, or why are some people, why are some entities animals or insects, and why are we at this, you know, if it was only a material situation that brought about the karma that put us where we're supposed to be, and how did it all begin? How did, you know?
How did what begin?
How did... you know, if we were, if they were all equal for a start, all the souls, then why did they all, how did they get to become unequal on the material plane?
Okay, let's look at the last line of the Sanskrit, text 14. Svabhavas tu pravartate. The modes of material nature are acting. The last line of the translation says, all this is enacted by the modes of material nature. All these differences and varieties of bodily manifestation, they are products of material influence.
So does that mean that a long time ago everyone started off equally and the material nature sort of influenced some people in some ways and others in others? So
it's hard to use a long time ago, but let us say that it's materially impossible to trace out the beginning of your immersion into illusion.
Yeah, fair.
But now that you have immersed yourself, now that we have immersed ourselves, material nature is carrying us like a mad rushing stream. And while we're being carried along, there are differences created in as we rise and fall, with our heads above and below the water. But these differences are the minor point compared to the main point that we are being swept away. So if you continue reading, we'll discuss that, and then I guess I'll have to bring up my Hook of Falls example. So please continue. Yes.
On paper of 14. I can't remember. Okay. As long as he is in the city of the body, he appears to be the master of it, but actually he is neither its proprietor nor controller of its actions and reactions. He is simply in the midst of the material ocean, struggling for existence. The waves of the ocean are tossing him, and he has no control over them. His best solution is to get out of the water by transcendental Krishna consciousness. That alone will save him from all turmoil.
Yes. So, there I was at Hook of Falls. You know, I was standing on the bridge overlooking. You've all been there?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the right was the, was it a lake or the river on the right before it goes over the waterfall? Is it?
The river.
It's a river. And then it, the river narrows into this channel. Mm-hmm. Does that channel go downhill? And the water is rushing through it like anything, you know. And then it goes over the waterfalls and into the river continues, is that it?
Yeah.
So, now, one of my cohorts, Baba, was telling me that last year, one very bright sportsman decided he was going to canoe. through the channel and down the falls. You heard about this?
Yeah, I heard what happened to him.
So, you know, of course, to do such a thing would seem to any person of average intelligence that would seem to be quite insane, but I guess probably we can imagine he was very proud of his athletic abilities and he wanted to prove a point, or maybe he just wanted to go out in a blaze of glory or something. Who can comment on his motives? So, anyway, just visualize the situation. First of all, what is he doing there? Everybody will agree. What is he doing there? What presumption, or what pride, or what foolishness, or what delusion, whatever. Anyway, he's there. Down the narrow stream he goes, underneath the bridge. You're all watching. And then over the falls. And from what I heard, when he got to the bottom of the falls, he was rising and falling for 20 minutes before he finally drowned, in full view of busloads of Japanese tourists. Now, what should we focus on? Should we focus on the individual stylistics as he was struggling. Just see his individuality. He's the creator of his own reality. Wonder what kind of swimsuit he has on. Is he watching the people on the shore? Can he see their auras? Is he cleansing their chakras? He can make his own reality. Life is what he makes it. You know, the guy's gasping and rising and falling, and just look at the individual way that he's rising and falling. Just see how creative he is. He's a co-creative partner with nature. Is that what we should focus on? Or, obviously, what we'll be focusing on is the power of nature, the overwhelming power of the waterfall, which makes the individual stylistics of this canoe man puny and insignificant, pointless to discuss. What do you think the people on the shore, the Japanese tourists on the shore, are thinking? Are they what? Just see his individual mannerisms, how artistic he is, how intuitive he is. I wonder how, just see, he's really using his intuition now. That last gasp of air he took before he went under for the 20th time, that was very intuitive. It was very well grounded. Oh, he's in the water, it can't be grounded. But it was definitely, he was co-creating with the water. No one's thinking like that. You're thinking, look at this huge waterfall. He's just an insignificant speck. He's finished. But what shall we do? We grab the people on the shore. Don't worry about the, why are you seeing the waterfall? Just focus on his individual creativity. Just look at that style. What brand of swimming trunks does he have on? What brand of canoe paddle is that paddle that he lost in the waterfall? These are things you should think of. No, it's all insignificant in comparison to the huge power of the waterfall. So yes, there is some individuality. We're not going to say there's no individuality in this display by this canoeist as he's at the bottom of a fall struggling for his life for 20 minutes. There is individuality. There is, he's definitely struggling in his own special way. But compared to the power of the waterfall, it's just foolish to talk about. And that's what this purport is explaining at the end here. He is simply in the midst of the material ocean, struggling for existence. The waves of the ocean are tossing him, and he has no control over them. His best solution is what? To manifest more individuality while he's struggling? No. His best solution is to get out of the water by transcendental Krishna consciousness. That alone will save him from all turmoil. And we can go back further. As long as he is in the city of the body, he appears to be master of it. But actually, he is neither his proprietor nor controller of his actions and reactions. So, the canoeist, he thought he had some controlling ability, but what's going on at the bottom of the waterfall is out of his control. So what if he can gasp for air longer than you can? So what? Just see, he took a breath of air for... He inhaled for 1 minute. I can only inhale for 30 seconds. Now that's real skill. What does it matter? What does it matter? Or shall we glorify him? He struggled for 20 whole minutes before he went under. Now that's real progress. I mean, the average Kiwi would have only lasted 5 minutes. That guy struggled for 20 minutes. Just see how human civilization is advancing. 20 minutes before he went down. That's a world record. So everybody will agree, this is ridiculous. But we should apply the same understanding to the living entities' struggle in the material cosmos. And then you'll see what you're up against. And why learned sages feel very sorry and compassionate when they hear people say that, oh, it's all up to you, it's all under your control. They don't understand the huge waterfall that's... dumping massive flows of material energy that the people are caught up in spite of their individual style. So it's not that the Bhagavad Gita is denying that they're individual styles, but the whole point is compared to the overwhelming waterfall of material energy, it's very insignificant to discuss. But you do become significant in your individuality when you get out of the turmoil. But as long as you're in the turmoil, you know, at the bottom of the Hook of Falls, there's this famous undercurrent. You just, you know, so much water is coming down so powerfully, and when it gets to the bottom, it just creates this. So as long as you're caught up in that, you're never mind what kind of style you have. In fact, never mind whether you're male, female, rich, poor, smart, dumb. You're just caught up in that. And in a few minutes, you're going to be finished. Now, externalists, they'll just look and see. Ram is talking about the external. The externalists will just see. Well, just look at the style that you're going under the water. That's really great style. I really like that style. When I get my chance, I'll try to imitate you. But of course, the overriding reality is that you are being overpowered. You're simply in the midst of the material ocean, struggling for existence. The waves of the ocean are tossing you, and you have no control over them. No control. This is just negative religious talk. We have no control. We can be whatever we want to be. We can control whatever we want to control. Yes, you have a tiny ability to control, just like the canoeist. He can decide, I'm going to wear red swim trunks instead of blue. Or I'm going to, when I get sucked under the water at the bottom of the Hook of Falls, I'm going to hold my breath for 3 minutes. That's longer than anyone else has done the Hook of Falls before. So yes, you have some control. But if you're going to talk about control, then you better look at the power of the falls. That's where the real control is. You have a tiny ability, but so what? So we have to always keep things in perspective. So all the differences that you see on the, getting back to Cheryl's question, all the differences that you see manifesting, all the different karmic varieties, they're just like the differences different swimmers would manifest when going under at the bottom of the Hook of Falls. They're there, but they're insignificant. They're differences created in a illusory situation, just like we all agree. Anybody who canoes over the falls is crazy. And why should we harp upon their differences? Similarly, for the humble sage who's equipped with true knowledge, he's not going to harp on differences created, you know, in a fatal situation.
How come some people get thrown a rope, you know, so to speak? I mean, Krishna consciousness, a way out. Some people don't have any kind of access to this. I mean, animals don't, you know? So we shouldn't, you know, worry about their individual dynamics or whatever. But if it's all just sort of access to this, to the soul, then how do you get to the point where you can get out? And is there any deciding factors that, you know?
Let's turn to page 290. Actually, first take a glance at the verse, text 15 on 289. We'll just glance at it. It's a very deep verse. We'll just glance at it before we go to the purport. Nadate kashchit papam nachayava sukritam vibhu ajaninavratam janam tena muyanti jantava. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. So on the next page, 290, we'll start at about the fourth line from the top. The Lord is the constant companion of the living entity as Paramatma, or the Supersoul. And therefore, he can understand the desires of the individual soul, as one can smell the flavor of a flower by being near it. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning for the living entity. The Lord fulfills his desires as he deserves. Man proposes and God disposes. The individual is not, therefore, omnipotent in fulfilling his desires. The Lord, however, can fulfill all desires, and the Lord, being neutral to everyone, does not interfere with the desires of the minute, independent living entities. However, when one desires Krishna, the Lord takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that one can attain to him and be eternally happy. desire.
Where does that come from?
You.
So,
when you desire the rope to be thrown, it gets thrown.
And the desire comes from the soul. Right?
Yes.
So if one soul has desire and another doesn't...
To get out?
Yeah, and another doesn't. Does that make them... Are they still equal then?
Yes. It's just one is less covered over than the other. One is less bewildered than the other. Just like gold, two pieces of gold that are the same weight. This is a rough material example. Two pieces of gold that are the same weight and the same characteristics. They are of the same quality, but they may be covered over by different degrees of dirt and mud. A rough example, but I think you get the point. So living entities are covered by different degrees of ignorance, but in their original condition, they're equal. So some living entities desire to have the rope thrown to them after struggling for 5 minutes at the bottom of the falls. Others can go on like that for lifetimes. But if you get my drift, everyone, unfortunately, is so fascinated by the trials and tribulations of struggling at the bottom of the falls. Oh, he's struggling in a new, unique way. Wow, that's never been seen before. No one's thinking, let's get out. So therefore, sometimes we can describe materialistic society as being like one big consensual truth. Quantitatively, the complete whole is within you.
No, qualitatively.
Quantitatively, the complete whole is there within you.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the infinite has infinite possibilities, it can be done. Therefore, we were just reading how from within the core of your heart, the complete whole can sense the desires of the tiny part.
Yeah, but are you saying that the manifestation of Krishna is within all of us? Is complete?
Yes, the complete whole is present within every part. Even within every atom. This is more detailed now. Even within every atom.
That's a pretty strange concept.
Why?
I think it seems like really...
Why?
Well, if Krishna is present in all of us, it would say, well, he's present in all of us. We sort of, I was going to say he's equal, but obviously we're not. That's a stupid thing to say, but it doesn't make sense.
Okay, let's go back to our text for today, page 294. We'll go down a little below the middle of that purport to the sentence beginning the similarity in the quality. Everyone see that? That's the 11th line from the bottom.
Okay.
I counted.
Yeah, that's what it's
doing.
Takes 18.
Qualitatively they're like, but quantitatively they're not.
Just go on, read it, please.
The similarity in the quality of the soul and the super soul, however, does not make them equal in quantity. For the individual soul is present only in that particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present in each and every body. A Krishna conscious person has full knowledge of this, and therefore he is truly learned and has equal vision. The similar characteristics of the soul and the super soul are that they are both conscious, eternal, and blissful. But the difference is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body, whereas the super soul is conscious of all bodies. The super soul is present in all bodies without distinction.
Yes. The difference is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body, whereas the super soul is conscious of all bodies.
So what you're saying is that we're conscious of the fact that we maybe have a soul, right? You can say, I think I've got something on the soul, whereas super soul is present in us because we're an expression of Krishna, but we're not aware of it.
You are conscious of, without even discussing whether you are conscious of your soul or not, because in the conditioned state, most people are not conscious of their original identity. They think, I am the body, I am the mind, I am the intelligence. So we'll not get into the point of whether we, in the conditioned state, are conscious of the soul. But we are conscious that we are conscious. I think, therefore I am, that much we can say. We are conscious that we are conscious. Of course, people don't know where consciousness has arisen. Science is just now starting to deal with the whole question or issue of consciousness. That's very new. Of course, how can you have science without understanding consciousness? Because it is consciousness that makes you aware of what you're studying in science. In other words, as St. Augustine said, what we are looking for is what we are looking with. So just now, Western science is starting to deal with consciousness. Of course, once you start dealing with consciousness, then even if you had some hope for Darwin's theory, how does Darwin's theory account for the evolution of consciousness? Of course, some scientists are trying to support that. So the point is, we are conscious that we are conscious. Now, for most people, they're in bodily consciousness, or these days it's getting a little more elevated on the material plane. They're conscious of their astral or subtle identities. From the Vedic point of view, in Bhagavad Gita, that's still bodily consciousness. Mind, intelligence, and ego, this is the astral body, as compared to the gross physical body. So still, even if you understand your psychic, subtle nature, you haven't gotten out of the bodily conception, according to Bhagavad Gita. Okay, so you're conscious. I am the body, I am the man, I am the mind. Now, just like you are conscious of the things happening in your limited sphere of existence, if you step on my toe, I'll be conscious of that. The complete whole, supersoul, is present in every body and is conscious of what goes on in every body, just like you are conscious of what goes on in your body.
Like, say you have a conversation with someone, right? You're conscious of the fact that they're in the room with you, and you're interacting with them. But as soon as they leave, or you can't see them anymore, you're not. I mean, they might as well not exist because you're only conscious of what interact. It's like really you can see something, but you're only assured of it as of its existence. Smell it or touch it in some way if it interacts with your senses. Is that right? And like,
and therefore?
And therefore, so you're only conscious of where you go in the world. So if you're in New Zealand, you're only conscious of New Zealand, but there's all this other stuff going on in other countries and other planets and other universes.
Yes.
But it might as well not all exist. You know, but the supreme consciousness might see it all.
Yes.
Yeah. It's hard to explain. It's like an idea. I can't put into words, but
what you're dealing with is solipsism. It's quite a bright 6-year-old young man here. Solipsism. That reality is only what I perceive. Because as you said, unless I perceive it, it doesn't exist. And when I stop perceiving it, it's as good as gone. In other words, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to perceive it, does that tree actually fall? In other words, if reality is only perceived by our individual consciousness, does that mean that if we're not perceiving something, it doesn't exist? But see, even if you're not looking at the tree falling in the forest, the supersoul sees it.
Yeah, that's what I was sort of getting at, because I've always speculated that there must be
an ultimate witness.
Yeah, there must be, because otherwise it might not exist on my mind, it might just be in this little bubble of reality and things just come into it. It's like
Okay, but then, Paul, what you have to figure out is what is the origin of this bubble of reality and the things that are coming into it? And then you get to the unifying factor.
Well, then you have to accept the fact that there's a super soul.
Later you'll find the Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, I'm the origin of everything material and spiritual. Everything emanates from me. So any more points on this before we move to number two?
When you said before, nobody decides to get out, what did you mean by that? Did you mean stop being in existence? Or because someone that commits suicide actually would be deciding to get out?
Yes, that's a good point. From the Vedic point of view, when you commit suicide, you're not getting out. You're still caught in the cycle of repeated birth and death.
Mm-hmm.
But under illusion, you think that you have found the solution, but there's that's not the solution.
Well, it's not the solution for the source, but it would be for the material.
For the
source, his son.
It would be the solution for what? The
material body.
Yes, right.
Because you get another one.
Well, temporarily. Would be a temporary illusion.
You get another body, and because you violated the laws of nature by committing suicide, by prematurely ending your bodily existence, you get more unfortunate situation in next life because you broke the law.
Yes.
Suicide is not predetermined.
No, that's wrong.
That's expressing a desire to get out, though, isn't it?
It would be
No. You don't get out that way. When I say get out, I mean, as stated in the end of the purport here, his best solution is to get out of the water by transcendental Krishna consciousness. That alone will save him from all turmoil. You've got to get out by spiritual methods. You can't get out by material means.
So there's only one way to get out. But does that mean that there's... if you want to get out, you want to get out. You know, whether you try it by swimming underneath the water, trying to find an underground cave, or say it's Krishna consciousness is someone throwing you a rope. Like, I mean, regardless of what way you're trying to get out, you still want to get out. So you said that people become more... are able to approach Krishna consciousness when they express a desire to get out. So they're expressing a desire to get out when they want to commit suicide because they want to get out, but they just went the wrong way.
Right. So desire to get out meaning you have to do it the right way. You have to reach for the rope. You can't speculate on your own under the influence of ignorance that by going deep under the water I'll find a hidden cavern or something. You see, someone who commits suicide is not thinking, I'm going to get out of material existence into the spiritual. They're just thinking, by doing this, I'll put an end to my material, I'll cease to be. That's not getting out.
It's not getting out on the spiritual.
To get out means to seek a spiritual solution.
But all death is suicide because the decision's been made somewhere. Well, hardly.
In one sense, that is true. But suicide, as we generally know it, means...
the material thing.
No. What I'm saying is suicide, as we know it, means you have decided to quit your body before the appropriate time. In another sense, looking at it from another point of view, every death is suicide in that the soul doesn't want to stay any longer because the situation is so painful. But... suicide means premature. Regular death is you leave at the right moment when you're supposed to. But in looking at it from another point of view for descriptive purposes, yes, you can say that. In that sense, in fact, our teacher Swami Prabhupada said like that. And looking at it from a special point of view, all death is like a suicide in that you want to get out, it's too painful. But it's not a suicide in that you're leaving at the right time.
Looking at it in that way, you said there is a different different decisions. One type of suicide is that you will just recreate another body.
Mm-hmm.
But the other type of suicide that you actually recognize, perhaps on the other end of the scale, if you talk about scales, you recognize Krishna and the decisions come from a higher source.
Oh, that is another thing. That is what you said at the end. That's another thing, totally. That is, I'm not in control. Let me go wherever the complete whole wants me to go. That is a very special kind of death. For one who dies like that, there's actually no birth or death. You're just changing buses at the terminal for the purpose of helping others. Because if you know all that, then you're capable of helping millions of people obtain their original consciousness. If you can die in that kind of consciousness, that I'm giving up this body, let me go wherever I can render the best service to the cause of all causes, that is the death of a sadhu. That's a saintly death. That means you're just changing buses, changing locations.
But in that, there's all the in between.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So I'm just trying to explain. Do you understand what I was trying to... From my point of view, that's the way I understand it. But there's all decisions. All decisions are made somewhere in the line. The quality of decision, if you want to think of the word on it.
Yes, so that's what Bhagavad Gita is dealing with, the quality of the decision. Now, most people, I must say, Ron, don't get as far as you come. They don't recognize the decision-making ability that they have. So Bhagavad Gita is trying to instill in people the realization that you are making decisions all the time, whether you recognize it or not. Now make the best decision. That's the whole purpose of Krishna speaking Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. Make the best decision. And you're right. The whole issue of Bhagavad Gita is the varying qualities of the decision-making process.
It always surprises me, you know, if, what's it called, what's that film called? It's on the 1st of April? Yes, that's right. But they say if you pull the ropes on the cart, then you're guaranteed return back to Godhead. But in actual fact, it always is, I find that a bit confusing, because if they want to pull it right from the cart, then they should do it without the expectation.
Well, I don't know that. Personally, I've not seen that statement anywhere in any of the Vedic texts. It's a nice notion, but also, even if that's so, when, that's up to you. Because in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, everyone follows his path in all respects. But, you know, although everyone's on the path, some are going backwards, some are going forward, mm-hmm. some are stalled, you see? So when you get to the end of the path, that's up to you.
Mm. I mean, when you get the end of the path, you mean it's when you attain Krishna consciousness.
When you achieve the goal of living in this world, to reform your rebellious tendencies and reharmonize your relationship with the complete whole, then you've reached the culmination. Now, everyone, looking at things from a broader point of view, everyone in this world is on that road back home. But some are stalled. Some are even going the opposite way. Because the whole purpose of the cosmic manifestation is that rebellious entities become reformed. Now, sometimes entities have to go through many bursts of criminal activities before they suffer enough and come to their senses. Still, they're within the reformatory institution. Therefore, in the fourth chapter of the Gita, Krishna says, everyone's on my path. But as they deal with me, I deal with them.
So people that actually live a very wicked life, they pay for it in the next life.
Every action has a reaction.
So you pay the price ultimately for whatever you do.
Immediately you pay for whatever you do, and ultimately.
Well, immediately it might not be apparent to you.
Right, immediately it's not apparent, but still you'll pay, because if you look at nature, you'll see that there are simply actions and reactions going on all the time, mm-hmm. whether or not you think it or not.
You think you can get away with it, you think you can get away with it.
Right. So another point of Bhagavad Gita is to teach you how to make decisions to free yourself from karma. Because as Krishna points out in the Bhagavad Gita, no one can stop acting, not even for a moment. Even when you think you're inactive and physically still, you're still acting. You're still interacting with nature. So karma is a very tricky, complex, and subtle thing. Now, how to cut the knot of karma? Well, that takes some precise decision-making and knowledge. Otherwise, you're just tossing and turning at the bottom of the hookah falls.
Yeah, but if you say you live a life, let's say you don't do it perfectly and you come back for another life, in more favorable circumstances, because you've lived a reasonable life twice at that point in previous life, that should set you up in a better position to improve yourself even more, move out of the material plane.
You're right, but who decides what the reasonable life is? Does the part or does the complete whole decide?
Well,
for example, let's just flip to...
Well, I mean, you draw upon some generally recognized benchmark, like a text like the Gita or maybe the Bible or the Quran.
You've got to
like
find
that.
An instruction book for the universe,
a
manual for the process.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean...
Let's turn to page 348, for example. You'll find some light on your question there. Chapter 6, text 37, page 348. Looks like we're not going to get the number 2 tonight, but that's okay. That's an issue in and of itself. I think Ron's chuckling about last week. Okay. Text 37. Let's read the Sanskrit here. Arjuna Uvacha. This is Arjuna speaking, not Krishna. Therefore, the Sanskrit says Arjuna Uvacha. Arjuna said, Ayati Shridayo Peto Yogach Chalita Manasa Aprapya Yoga Sam Siddhin Kangatin Krishna Gachati. Would you like to read the translation, Glenn?
I think this is on
348.
Arjuna said, Oh Krishna, what is the destination of the unsuccessful transcendentalist who in the beginning takes on the process of self-realization with faith, but who later desists due to worldly mindedness and thus does not attain perfection in mysticism?
Aprachisto mahabaho vamudo brahmanapati. One read, please. No, the translation of the next verse, 38.
Okay.
Almighty Arm Krishna.
Yep, Almighty Arm Krishna, does not such a man who is bewildered from the path of transcendence fall away from both spiritual and material success and perish like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere?
Yes, Arjuna is saying, Krishna, it seems to me, O complete whole, that if I, the part and parcel, take up spiritual practice, but I fail due to weakness and worldly mindedness, I blow it both ways. I don't get material success or spiritual success. Well, I think all the best questions and answers are there in Bhagavad Gita.
You can blow spiritual success and not for material success, don't you? Mm-hmm.
But you see, because you, the point behind Arjuna's question is that, I've drop material activities to go for the spiritual, but then due to weak mindedness, I can't handle the spiritual. So then I've blown it both ways.
You're right.
So he's asking that. So now, text 39, page 350. Arjuna is still talking, because this is an important question. So therefore, he's basically taking three verses to generate it. Etanme samsayam Krishna chetam arhasya sheshata. Pranya samsaya syasya chetana hipapadyate.
This is my doubt, O Krishna, and I ask you to dispel it completely. But for you, no one is to be found who can destroy this
Okay, text 40. Now Krishna will speak. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. This Sanskrit word, Bhagavan, in case you haven't studied the introduction, Bhaga means opulence. Van means possessor. The cause of all causes, the ultimate source, is not qualityless. Everything is there in the source that is in what comes from the source. How can what comes from the source have more than the source? The cause of all causes, the infinite reservoir, has everything, at least, that the emanations have.
If you've got a teacher, right, and they teach somebody, just saying, the teacher is the source and the student is the product. Sometimes the student becomes, you know, more addicted at what the teacher taught them, you know?
Right, but when I'm saying that the cause of all causes has at least what the emanations have, I'm speaking in terms of energy and the source of energy, in terms of completeness. The ultimate has to have whatever the emanations have. Otherwise, the ultimate is not complete. It's not the ultimate. So if you accept that there's an ultimate, then obviously the ultimate has at least what the non-ultimates have. So therefore, the Sanskrit term Bhagavan is applied to Krishna. The cause of all causes has everything that the tiny parts and parcels have, and infinitely more so. Otherwise, there's no meaning to the Supreme as the infinite. That means personality, qualities, form, all those things, but they are present in perfection. That's the difference. Whereas these things are present in us, in our conditioned state, in a troublesome way. And even in our liberated state, they're present still in a tiny way. Okay. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Parta Naivehanam Mutra Vinashas Tasya Vijate Vihi Kalyana Krit Kashchid Durgatin Tata Gashchati. In translation.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, Son of Patra
Prita.
Prita. Transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil.
Okay, now we're in the next verse, text 41, we're going to start to get some specific information on the fate of an unsuccessful yogi. Prapya punya kritam lokan ushitva shashpati sama Suchinam Shimatam Gehe Yoga Brasto Bajayate. Isn't this exciting?
Please read that. The unsuccessful yogi, after many, many years of enjoyment on the planets of pious living entities, is born into a family of righteous people and into a family.
Or
into a family of rich aristocracy.
Yes. So, what we're seeing in the purport, a little brief delineation here. The unsuccessful yogis are divided into two classes. One who has fallen after very little progress, and one who has fallen after long practice of yoga. The yogi who falls after a short period of practice goes to the higher planets, where pious living entities are allowed to enter. This is what most religions refer to as heaven. In the Vedic system, that will refer to the upper planetary system, where conditions for material happiness far exceed what's available on the earth. But still, it's the material world. Go to the next verse, where it describes the second class of yogis. Atava yogi nameva kule bhavati jimatam eta di durlabhataram loki jama yadidrasam.
For if unsuccessful after long practice of yoga, he takes his birth in a family of transcendentalists, quite surely great in vision
wisdom.
And wisdom, sorry, certainly such a bird that's rare in this world. All right, so we've seen two types. A transcendentalist who fails after a short time of practice, and one who fails after a long period of practice. One who fails after a short period, he takes his birth in a family of either a very righteous, spiritually minded family, or in a rich family. Now, obviously, both those kind of families give you advantages in pursuing your tendency for self-realization. A rich family means you don't have to worry about the basic necessities. Ideally, you'll have lots of time for spiritual cultivation. And taking birth in a priestly family means that you'll be around, you'll be in a setting where cultivation of spiritual knowledge is the norm.
It would appear to me that the yogic practitioner who's been practicing for a long time, being born into a spiritual family.
This doesn't say now spiritual family in this first run. It says pious. Pious means righteous from the ordinary religious point of view. You know, knows how to live in this world in a non-sinful way. But it doesn't say spiritual, it says pious. You see, in Bhagavad Gita, there's a complete difference between piety and spirituality. Just like Arjuna didn't want to fight the battle. That was a pious decision made on the basis of piety. But Krishna, the complete whole, overruled them on the basis of spirituality. It's a very important point to grasp in our reading of the Gita. And that's why Bhagavad Gita is so provocative. Piety was overruled for spirituality.
So is piety...
good karma. The Vedic texts have many prescriptions for good karma, how to go to the higher planets, the heavenly planets. Planting trees, giving charity to people who are worthy of charity, doing good deeds, living in such a way that your distress caused living entities is minimized, vegetarian, living an honest life according to even Judeo-Christian standards, living that kind of life, but also not participating in the web of animal slaughter. Not only refraining from bad karma, but cultivating good karma. Living in harmony with nature, according to according to scriptural instructions how to live. That's piety.
The point I was making, I think, agreeing with what this says, that text 41 translation, the person who has undertaken, what translates pursue a spiritual dimension for a short period, not very successfully, is likely to be born into a rich family of aristocracy or a pious family. But that being a pious family is all very well, but he's not in as good a position as the person who pursued spiritual lifestyle for a longer period of time, born into a...
Right, so let's turn to text 42. Very good.
Born into a transcendental...
okay, text 42.
Is that right?
Yes. Atava yoginam eva kule bhavati dhimatam eta dhidra lavataran loke jama yaridrasam. Yes. Or, if unsuccessful, after long practice of yoga, he takes his birth in a family of transcendentalists who are surely great in wisdom. Certainly such a birth is rare in this world. There is a complete difference. Birth in a family of yogis or transcendentalists, that is different from birth in a pious family.
And it being born, as going back to text 41 again.
Text what? 41?
Text 41, translation again. That could be seen as a disadvantage in some ways, because a person born into a rich family where everything is provided for them is likely to become lazy,
right,
and go to sleep.
Right.
A person born into this family of transcendentalists is not going to go to sleep.
Okay, you're right.
Going to get on with the job.
Right. And a person born into a pious family, a priestly family, he
he may get just, he or she may become attached simply to the rituals of religion and piety and being righteous in the ordinary material sense, and mistake that for the essence, which is complete harmonization,
so
the desires of the complete whole. So yes, the previous two and 41 are, yes, there's danger there. Obviously, what is described in text 42 is the most secure position. Still, you can take birth in the most auspicious family of transcendentalists, and still you can go your own way. Therefore, the best thing is finish your business in this lifetime. Don't take birth again. Can do it.
So it's not like you sort of try and try all your life and then you sort of fail. How do you fail? Put it that way.
As Krishna says in the previous verse, Arjuna, when he's asking the questions to Krishna, on page 348, text 37, let's bring things to a close here. He says, who later desist due to worldly mindedness. In other words, you become attracted to the external, as Ram was saying in the beginning, and forget the internal, and forget the source of both the external and the internal.
Is that very likely to happen, or is it just up?
You have your independence to choose properly or to choose improperly. No one can take away your independence from you.
It would seem to me that matters. People's out there and people's life all the time, you know, it's always a temptation to take the so-called instant gratification.
But side by side with the temptation, there's the rope being thrown your way. But we don't see the rope.
Yeah, exactly. I don't see the rope.
No, because we don't want to see the rope.
Well, because it's not that obvious.
It is, but we've got a problem number two, which we'll have to deal with next week.
But I think Paul mentioned the word failure, but like, didn't those few verses really say that you don't fail in a sense? Mm. It's not failure, that you will, even if you've made just some beginning in,
right.
in spiritual pious activity
right.
or yogic activity, then
exactly.
It's not actually failure.
Right. Then you're echoing a verse in chapter 2. Swapalopya Siddharmasya, what number is that? What number is that?
It's 220 something. I remember someone saying to me that what you learn in spirit about Krishna or you never forget. Doesn't matter if you get covered over for a while, once you wipe all that dust, what you do last time you never forget.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Look at the Sanskrit index in the back. It's exactly what Cheryl was alluding to in chapter 2. Actually, there's no failure, so you should just push on.
Except you realizing that that's the point.
But nevertheless, that you don't want to use that as a false cushion and say, well, it doesn't matter how hard I try, because you want to get the job done. What is it?
240, page 125.
Page 125. Chapter 2, text 40, page 125. We'll bring it to our grand conclusion here. Neha vikramanashosti pratyavayo navijyate swapamapyasya dharmasya triyate mato bayat. Would you like to read the translation, Cheryl?
In this endeavor, there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear.
Now, what is that most dangerous type of fear? The Sanskrit word for fear is bhaya. Is it fear of losing your job? Fear of losing your husband or wife? Fear of losing your child? No. The greatest fear is that you will waste your human form of life and go back into the animal species and lose the special chance the human body gives, because only in the human form of life can you have discussions like we're having now. That is the greatest fear. So, would you like to please read the first paragraph of the purport?
Me?
Yes, please.
Activity in Krishna consciousness, or acting for the benefit of Krishna without expectation of sense gratification, is the highest transcendental quality of work. Even a small beginning of such activity finds no impediment, nor can that small beginning be lost at any stage. Any work begun on the material plane has to be completed, otherwise the whole attempt becomes a failure. But any work begun in Krishna consciousness has a permanent effect, even though not finished. The performer of such work is therefore not at a loss, even if his work in Krishna consciousness is incomplete. 1% done in Krishna consciousness sees permanent results, so that the next beginning is from the point of 2%, whereas a material activity without 100% success there is no profit. Ajamila performed his duty in some percentage of Krishna consciousness, but the result he enjoyed at the end was 100% by the grace of the Lord.
Yes. This particular example, Ajamil, he went through several births. So looked at from the overall point of view, yes, there's no failure. But we want to bring things to a head as quickly as possible, because that's our natural position. Why delay what is organic and continue in an artificial, synthetic way?
Because it's pleasurable material.
Next week. Tune in next week. What is real pleasure? Next week. We'll call next week next week's topic, heaps of pleasure. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Been a great, great pleasure for me. Very enlivening. Just stimulating assemblies. So we can all go downstairs. Dinner, that was the light.